Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
These days, getting it first seems more important than getting it right. This is Soundcheck. I'm John Schaefer. It used to be that critics wouldn't review a show or a record until it was ready to be reviewed. How 20th century that all seems. And the reviews are in. Critics still love the Microscopic Septet. They'll join us to play live. In the background, you're hearing a bit of the score to the new mega musical, Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. It was composed by Bono and The Edge from the band U2. The much-talked-about, much-delayed $65 million production got its first preview performance this week, and it was a little rocky thanks to some technical problems. Bloggers and newspaper reporters were quick to write about it. In fact, everybody seems to be writing about it, except the critics. They'll wait till it officially opens on January 11th. Joining us by phone to talk about this old Broadway pact between producers and critics is Alisa Solomon, professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism, and David Cote, theater editor for Time Out New York. Alisa, David, welcome back to the program.
Thanks.
Thanks, John.
Let me start with you, Alisa. Why does this tradition exist in the first place of holding off until opening official opening night?
Well, it exists because shows usually need to spend a little time in front of an audience before they know how they're working. And so the preview period, or what used to be more commonly the out-of-town tryout period, was a chance for playwrights, directors, songwriters, actors to get a sense of how things were working in a show. And they used to make really big changes from the early weeks of out-of-town tryouts or previews to the opening night, and the critics were invited to come to see the finished product.
So you'd be in New Haven, Connecticut, was a favorite place in the old days, trying out your show for a couple of weeks, and then when it was ready for prime time, that's when you brought it to Broadway, and that's when the critics sat in the aisle and wrote their reviews.
That's right. But that said, the out-of-town tryouts did get reviewed in the local press.
Mm-hmm.
So if you were in Detroit or Washington or New Haven, the papers in those towns would cover your show.
David, how far back a tradition is this? I mean, has this always been a part of your job as a reviewer?
Well, I've only been in the reviewing racket, you know, since 2000, but I tried to dig around and find out a little bit about when they started creating the press previews, those special performances, about 3 or 4 days before the actual opening night where critics could attend. Because for forever it had been this case where, yeah, the critics would come on opening night, and, you know, the opening night curtain was usually a little bit earlier. They were seated on the aisle. As soon as the final curtain came down, they rushed up the aisle to file their reviews in like 2 hours.
Mm-hmm.
Now, of course, we go about 3 or 4 days before the show opens, maybe 2 days before it opens, and we have a little time to mull it over and to, you know, give to sort of weigh our response to the show. But as far as I can guess, it's the press preview tradition started in the late 70s, early 80s. Some are saying that Clive Barnes's replacement at the New York Times started it in the like 78 or 79, or that Frank Rich started it in the early 80s when Pirates of Penzance moved to Broadway. So I can't find the flashpoint where it happened, but it basically the early 80s has started becoming
But
commonplace.
The point being that there was a preview show specifically for critics.
Yeah, I mean, they would attend, of course, you know, with a majority of regular audience members, although, of course, the producers would want to paper it with, you know, friends of the show.
Yeah.
It was basically about 30 years now. I guess critics have been coming a little bit earlier.
Definitely, at least when I started reviewing at The Voice in the early 80s, that was already a very firm tradition.
Mm-hmm. It's interesting what Alisa says about the out-of-town tryout, that tradition, which is this season certainly we're seeing much less of that. A lot of shows, a lot of musicals are just opening cold on Broadway. And it's interesting, at that first preview of Spider-Man, there was a woman in the audience, in the orchestra, who shouted out, you know, I feel like, I don't know about you, but I feel like I'm a guinea pig audience. And it's like, well, yeah, you are.
Yeah.
If you're going to pay, you know, $120 or whatever to see a first preview, you're probably going to see something that's not finished.
And do people really know that when they're shelling out $120 a pop?
Well, $120. I mean, David, you said that like $120 wasn't so much for a show, but you know, that's a lot of cash.
Yeah, that's $240 if it's you and a friend or
I don't want to downplay that. That is a lot of money. I mean, I think that you know everybody talks about the exorbitant prices for Broadway shows, and it's true they are. And then they go up, you know, to like $250 for the so-called premium seats. But, I mean, I don't want to defend the tickets on Broadway. They're ridiculous. But, you know, things in culture cost a lot, you know, not just Broadway. But I don't know. I mean, there are people like there's the whole culture of sort of flop vultures or just people who are crazy about previews who I think especially go to previews to see something that's a bit raw. But, yeah, sure, there are plenty of tourists, I'm sure, who probably don't know what they're getting into when they buy the tickets.
But there is certainly something to be said for having the curtain pulled back a bit to reveal the process, whether you want it pulled back as much as apparently happened during the first preview performance of the Spider-Man musical is another thing, where five times they had to stop the show and kind of work out over a period of several minutes what to do next or how to do it. But meanwhile, you know, the producers themselves are getting involved because they're putting out this all-points marketing campaign, including the star of the show, Reeve Carney, with his band Carney, performing on ABC's Good Morning America back in September. It's a compass and a map, the key to the jar. Song's called Boy Falling from the Sky, and that is Reeve Carney, who plays Peter Parker / Spider-Man in the new Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. Boys Falling from the Sky, a big part of the technical problems of that. Lots of flying and turning that into a relative safe experience for the actors is something that occupied the producers for a long time. We're speaking with Alisa Solomon from Columbia J School, former critic at The Village Voice, and with David Cody, the theater editor at Time Out New York. And we're talking about the fact that this show is only in previews. It's only started in previews. It officially opens January 11th. That's when the critics officially weigh in, and yet it seems like everybody else is already talking about it, including, I may say, David, you. Here you are.
I know. I have to wonder whether this is good for me professionally because I'm just, you know, I blogged about it for The Guardian and at Time Out, and I shouldn't be thinking this much about a show that's still in previews, probably.
Well, Alisa, what are the ethics of, you know, being a critic? And there is this, it's a tradition, it's not a written rule or anything.
No, it's not a written rule. It's a kind of little dance that that producers and critics have played all these years where, you know, in exchange for free press tickets, we let you tell us when we're invited. And the sort of other unsaid piece of it is that, you know, plus you advertise in our publication. And that's pretty much how it's been done. But I think that there are a lot of things that are threatening this paradigm, and it's maybe time to open it up. You know, what if they didn't give press tickets at all? What if critics just went, bought tickets like anyone else, went repeatedly? Sure, they could, you know, maybe the price would go up when they declared it done, and the press would be asked to indicate whether they were seeing a preview or the completed production. But I wonder if this high stakes, opening night, make or break kind of criticism is even working in the kind of Broadway economy we have anymore.
Well, but it's not just the Broadway economy, at least. I mean, is it realistic to expect that nobody else is going to beat all of the major critics to the punch? I mean, there are hundreds of reviews of this thing online already.
That's water cooler chat, right, that's happening digitally as opposed to what you might regard as a considered professional judgment from a critic. But, yeah, those boundaries are collapsing more and more.
David?
Yeah, I think you see, definitely over the last 5 or 10 years, you do see a little bit more kind of gawker, gossip, message board type of, I can't say aesthetic, but sensibility entering reviews where, you know, critics for the, you know, for very vaunted publications such as the New York Times engage in a certain amount of, you know, they name drop or they refer to topical events or they allude to backstage turmoil. It's not part of the common procedure, but it's not unheard of to, you know, just as, again, to mention Clive Barnes in the 60s, just as he was supposedly one of the first critics to introduce the first person, you know, the I, in his reviews, you know, critics are more and more probably talking about the meta of a show. Mm-hmm. It's interesting to me as a critic because I'm always wrestling with that question of how much should I know going into a show? Should I read the script? Should I, if there are previous performances of it, should I go and look at a video of the last revival? Should I read all the original reviews of a show? Ideally, the critic would go in completely, you know, soaked in information and background. Maybe.
Really? Or would the ideal be the exact opposite, to go in completely fresh without preconceived notions?
Well, I think the ideal is both. I mean, I think you learn as much as you can, and then you have to practice a little zen emptiness when those house lights go down.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
All right, then, David, since your official review isn't time for that yet till January, you're going to need to plug your ears for a few seconds here while we play a little bit of the music that Bono and The Edge wrote for the musical called Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark. You didn't have to plug your ears for that long. There isn't a whole lot of music available yet, although I'm sure by week's end somebody will have put something on YouTube somewhere. David Cote with us from Time Out New York. Alisa Solomon, professor at Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism and longtime theater critic herself. In the music world, it used to be that you didn't review a record until its official date, even if it was sent to your radio station, you know, a month or two in advance. It would be embargoed. We'll talk about how that has changed as well in a little while. But, you know, a similar thing in the theater, you did not officially review a show until it opened after its previews. Well, Spider-Man began its previews. The mainstream critics are holding off till January 11th, but there is lots being written and said about Spider-Man Turn Off the Dark, including, Alisa, I was interested to see the producer today in the New York Times saying that ticket sales have been actually quite good despite, you know, the initial reports of what was a very glitchy opening preview.
Well, yeah, I was gonna mention that because I think that for all of the screaming that the producers are doing about the violation of the sacred date of the opening, I think this is actually helping them, and I think that they're enjoying fanning these flames. It's creating a lot of buzz and publicity. There's a lot of, you know, people want to go to see something malfunction. You know, there's a certain Schadenfreude, at least, if not kind of excitement, and I think it's maybe, you know, maybe a little grandiose, but still possibly worthwhile to think about this in the same kind of context of the current debate over the WikiLeaks.
Mm-hmm.
You know, because really the underlying question here is the conflict between the producer's right to privacy or right to control the discourse around their product and the public's right to know. Now, you know, the nature of what it is we have a right to know is considerably different in this debate, but I think that's really the underlying questions, and these are the kinds of questions that media in general are facing on a whole realm of subjects.
Well, in In the New York Post, their columnist, you know, used words like epic flop after that opening preview, and high-tech gadgetry went completely awry amid a dull score and baffling script. Theatergoers griped. I mean, this is not reporting. This is actually a review at this point.
That's Michael Riedel of the New York Post, mm-hmm. who kind of allows people to mistake him for a theater critic now and then.
Or for a scrupulous journalist.
No, he's definitely in the creative nonfiction realm. The thing is, what makes a show success? What makes it a mega success that runs for 5 or 10 years and makes, you know, $1.5 or $2 million a week in box office? No one knows the answer, but this show certainly is being talked about, and the talk is being talked about to such an extent that it's, you know, it's becoming famous for being famous.
Yes,
whether you think
yes.
it's whether there are any aesthetic, you know, judgments being made around it.
Well,
it,
you know, having U2, having a $65 million budget, and even mm-hmm. before those previews, you know, reports of people being hurt with all the flying and stuff, this, you know, it's kind of a fun thing to talk about.
Mm-hmm.
Some of our listeners are talking about it. Producer Joel Meyer with a comment in the control room. Joel?
John, I just want to say I'm looking at the phone lines right now here in the control room, and they're all lit up, and they're all from Michael Riedel's office. But we do have one comment that I wanted to share with you. Dennis from Rutherford, New Jersey, obviously someone involved in theater. Dennis writes, I was involved in Nick and Nora in the early 90s. Mm. We had 71 previews and were the only thing opening that fall. Talk about being a target. It was the only show that anyone talked about all fall, and we took some serious hits. As a consequence, we ran only for 9 shows. I'm not sure how much longer we would have run without all the negative attention, but it certainly didn't help our reception.
Alisa, do you believe that? I mean, is there any such thing as bad publicity?
I think there is bad publicity, but I don't know if that's what killed that show. I didn't happen to have seen it, but I think there's not necessarily causation in that coincidence.
Well, there's also, I mean, 11 new musicals opening in the current season, 10 of them, like Spider-Man, with original music. So, you know, they're not the only game in town, but they are the game that everyone seems to be following at this point.
It's hard to find a real causation between, I mean, to go back to reviews, actual reviews, it's hard to find a real causation between critical consensus, either pro or anti a show, and its success or failure. You can just find many examples where, I mean, and unfortunately the Times always comes up in these discussions because it happens to be the biggest sort of media outlet in the city. But, you know, if the Times, you know, gave a mixed to negative review of Wicked, and that was a huge hit. Or mm-hmm. it gave
which,
a very...
by the way, excuse me, David, but mm-hmm. also that Wicked did terrible on its out-of-town tryouts in San Francisco, I think it was.
Yes,
terrible negative press there.
They did, but they did a lot of tweaks between San Francisco and New York. And who knows? I mean, 6 weeks of previews is a lot of time to fix some
right, exactly.
problems.
So there really is, I mean, I think, you know, no one is debating whether previews are a good idea. It's the question is, It's exactly as the two of you were talking about. It's a chance for the producers, the director, the actors to kind of get to know their material, to shape it. I mean, Fela, you know, they had a whole off-Broadway life before it came to Broadway. Even so, they needed previews to kind of pair 50 and then 30 and then 20 minutes down from what was a really big show. I mean, do you want critics watching you trim your fat like that?
I think it would be I mean, first of all, I think it's just I'm continually fascinated by the whole idea of both out-of-town tryouts and previews. The idea that the producers and the creative team are actively watching the audience watch their show to, you know, it's a real weird focus group situation that it's pretty unique in art. I mean, you don't have painters who, you know, necessarily bring people in to watch them dab a canvas. But I don't know. I mean, if you had a really creative producer out there, I mean, they'd either hire a dramaturg or they'd hire a critic who wasn't actually reviewing the show to sit in on a production and give feedback. But I don't know if that would necessarily be helpful, but it could be a creative idea.
It would make one critic happy, I guess. Alisa Solomon, professor at Columbia University Graduate School of Journalism, longtime theater critic. David Cody, theater editor for Time Out New York. We've been talking about the talk about Spider-Man, Turn Off the Dark. Nice talking with both of you.
Thanks
a lot.
Here's a little bit from Fela the Musical, post-preview, as it sounded when it eventually officially opened.
Wife buys food for family. Petty thief comes and steals her food. If wife no cook, man beats his wife. If I don't pay cop, he beats my ass. Landlord says you must pay more rent. Petty official wants 20 more percent.
As I mentioned a few minutes ago, early reviews aren't just a matter for theater. It's also been a tradition in music. And up next, we'll hear how music critics are also eager to get the first word in, regardless of the official release date. And then later, the Microscopic Septet. They've been away for some 18 years, but they're back with music by Thelonious Monk live in the Soundcheck studio.